Welcome to the Ryan Massano Show, where eternal truths, divine insight, and traditional values are championed. Remember, truth is hate for those who hate the truth. So for the next 2 hours, enjoy this sanctuary of traditional values, eternal truths, and divine insights. Now here's your host, Ryan Massano.
Okay, so we just got this link established here, and had a little bit of difficulties, but again, this is the Ryan Massano Show. You're on Speak Free Radio. Thank you for tuning in. For those who are with us today, apologize for the first about 40 minutes. Apparently, it was not working, so it is now, and we should be good to go. So the show is on from 3 to 5 Pacific time. That's on Saturdays. It's also on from 6 to 8 Eastern Standard Time. If you want to come into the call and chat, that would be great. After the show, Jim Rizzoli and Diane King will have their show. So that's just something to look forward to. So we got a few things at 4 o'clock, which is 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We'll have Dave Gaheri come back on. He was a guest on last week. And we were speaking about a lot. He was a fellow nuclear submariner. He was on fast attacks. I was on ballistic missile submarines. Also, we will add a little bit to discuss as far as a there's a great professor from the University of Oklahoma who I came across in the library of all places about 15, 20 years ago. And I probably learned more about Greek and Roman history from him than I ever learned anywhere else. So I wanted to go over one of his courses, which we have about 22 minutes to do that. If you want to call in, go ahead, the little black triangle. That's the way to do it on Speak Free Radio. And we will proceed. So this past week, again, wanted to go over a few details. We found that Mexico has a new president, and the new president is a woman, the first female president elected in Mexico history. And her name is Claudia Sheinbaum, which for those who know how to see these things, you know that's not a Latino name. And you're right, it's not Spanish. It's a Jewish name. So the first female president elected in Mexico's history is a Jew. How's that happen when Mexico is 98% Catholic? It seems like severe disproportionate power. That's what it seems like. It doesn't seem like it is. When the Jews control America, Mexico, matter of fact, you'd be very safe in assuming they control virtually all the countries on this entire earth. And they're just basically pitting us all against each other as they wish, because they control the militaries. And if they pay people, they'll go fight. So that's a dangerous, dangerous event. When Jews have this kind of power, they had this kind of power in China and Russia, and 100 million were killed. So there's really no time to waste in exposing what they're up to and removing them from power. They should not control the American Federal Reserve. They should not be controlling the income tax. That's who does. You could go on Google and try to find out who owns the Federal Reserve. Good luck with that. Unless you research the history, you'll never find out who controls the Federal Reserve. But it's definitely Talmudic Jews that do. That's why you can't find their name. We don't know where they live. So we are in a bit of a difficult situation, but that's why I wanted to focus on this professor from the University of Oklahoma. His name is J. Rufus Fears. I came across him in the learning courses in the library probably 15, 20 years ago. Actually, no. Yeah, it was 20, about this 20 years ago, at least. Could have even been more. And there was two courses, Famous Romans and Famous Greeks. And he's done a few other courses too, which are really amazing. He's done one on classic books and the lessons from history. One drawback is he never really seemed to have learned the Jewish question. So he always thought that Hitler was this terrible, bad, evil guy and Churchill was some kind of hero. when definitely Churchill and FDR were controlled by Talmudic Jews, along with Stalin. As far as Hitler, I'm kind of undecided about that, but time will tell. But other than that, he's very, very, very learned on a lot of these things. So Rome was in a difficult situation too, but Rome learned never, never, never surrender. Just, I think it's pretty inspirational just to even think about how Rome started. Rome started out of the ruins of King Priam in Troy. So many people read the Odyssey and the Iliad, which should be standard reading in all of our schools, and they think that that's a fairy tale and mythology. Well, maybe some of the gods, Jupiter, Zeus, Athena, maybe that's all mythological. But the actual events definitely did happen. Heinrich Schliemann, in the last 200 years, a German who made a couple fortunes, I don't know if he was Jewish, I doubt it though, he actually uncovered Troy, found a lot of its riches. And so after the downfall of Troy, when Troy was destroyed by the Greeks, out of that came Aeneas. And Aeneas had two sons, Romulus and Remus, and those were the founders of Rome. So it's amazing how a city was destroyed, a powerful city, which was the Trojans. And out of that came Rome, one of the most powerful world empires in world history. So something to remember. Now, Rome, one of the most powerful enemies that it ever faced was Hannibal. And Hannibal was arguably one of history's greatest generals. What he accomplished with very little manpower is just astonishing to think about. And it wasn't even manpower from just the Carthaginians. Hannibal was from Carthage, which modern day Tunisia. Rome destroyed Carthage utterly, completely. But what Hannibal accomplished with basically a mercenary army of mixed cultures, just absolutely fascinating. I mean, he would take 20,000 men and wipe out 70,000 Romans. And this is before you had like gunpowder and all this. So this is just pretty amazing, his battlefield tactics and what he did to fire up his troops with, I mean, they were in enemy territory, so they didn't have supply lines. They were living off the land and routinely three times just utterly crushed Roman armies. So let's see, we have about 16 minutes left. I'll just go ahead and listen to one of his. This is from Famous Romans. It's on Hannibal. And I'd highly recommend looking him up. You could actually, if you type in archive, you could actually listen to his lectures for free. Teaching company offers them. I think it's on Audible. He's got one, The Wisdom of History, Famous Books That Will Change Your Life. Just an astonishing breadth of knowledge that he has. So here he is, and this is J. Rufus Fears from the University of Oklahoma, who passed away in 2012, sadly, was just a phenomenal professor. I never took his class, but I feel like I did because I listened to the teaching company in his car. Every single series that he's released, I've listened to it. You could probably skip the one on Churchill, though, because that's disinformation. Not intentionally, but here we go.
In our last lecture, we looked at the aristocratic figure of Publius Cornelius Scipio, consul of the year 218. And through his eyes and those of his son, Publius Cornelius Scipio, viewed those qualities which were essential to Rome and played such a prominent role in its rise to greatness. For by the year of the consulship of Scipio in 218, Rome was master of a confederation that included all of Italy, south of the Po River, as well as governing Sicily. A confederation able to put some 500,000 men into the field, prosperous, valiant, disciplined, and expansionistic. And we ended our lecture with the declaration of war between Rome and Carthage. What would be the second war between these two mighty powers? The historian Polybius recognized the importance of the Second Punic War for the
Okay, Polybius is one of the great historians. See, we don't learn this stuff in school, barely. You're lucky to learn it in college, and you certainly won't be learning it from the media and in the libraries most of the time, because the libraries are full of woke garbage now. But Herodotus, Polybius, Plutarch, Thucydides, you know, these historians from Greece and Rome are very, very fascinating, because with all of the technology, we have so many people today who think that, oh, you know, we have the internet, we have cell phones, nobody's ever had that before, so we are the best of all times. But what they forget is that one variable, or that's not a variable, one aspect never changes no matter what technology does, and that is human nature. And so by studying the past and studying history, we can learn human nature, learn from other people's lives, and apply those lessons to our lives. And by doing that, we improve our lives, we improve our nations, and we improve the world. One thing you'll find with any successful society from Greece to Rome to early America is they were very historically astute. They studied history, they applied it, they learned the lessons of history, they made it a priority of theirs to learn history. That was more, wisdom from history was more important to a lot of these people than actually making money. Today, it's the exact opposite. Most people are so concerned about my 401k, paying off my mortgage, taking a vacation, which I'll be taking a vacation to Yosemite next week, but that's not my priority. I think I've gone to Yosemite three times in the past in my entire 44 years. So definitely not excessive when I do things. But so let's continue.
History of the entire classical world. Polybius is worthy to rank with Thucydides as a historical mind. He understood the importance not only of the war between Rome and Carthage, but he also lived at Rome and understood the mind of the Roman. Originally brought as a hostage from Greece, he came from a distinguished family. His father had been an important politician, and Polybius won the favor and friendship of the house of the Scipios. He would grow up in that family. He would read the archives and materials of that family and develop the most profound admiration for Publius Cornelius Scipio, the consul of 218, as well as his son, who would one day defeat Hannibal. Polybius lived close enough to the events so that he could actually interview men who had fought in the Second Punic War, including men who crossed the Alps with Hannibal. So for the first time with the Second Punic War and with the history of Polybius, we stand on solid ground in examining the story of Rome. Now, the Romans expanded first in Italy, and then no sooner, in 270, were they masters of all of Italy. Then they began to expand overseas to Sicily, and this brought them into conflict with Carthage. For the island of Sicily had long been viewed by the Carthaginians as their sphere of influence. More than once in succeeding periods after the colonization of Sicily by the Greeks, the Carthaginians had tried to conquer it. And in 264, Rome and Carthage began their great war. Carthage in 264 was the dominant naval power. Rome barely had a navy. Some of its Greek allies had navies, but not the Romans themselves. And yet the Romans demonstrated those great qualities of valor and perseverance, which were the foundation of their success. They would lose battle after battle, but they would never lose a war. For remember the lesson they had learned from the Gauls, with which we concluded our last lecture. Vae victis, woe to the conquered. The conquered have no rights. And so when the Romans found themselves losing naval battles.
Let's go over that here real briefly. Those are two words everybody should know in Latin. Vae victis, woe to the conquered. It goes back, the Gauls had conquered Rome long before and had made an agreement with Rome about what the surrender fees would be. So back in those days, they didn't have scales like we have today. They had old scales where you put a certain amount of weight on one side and then you had to balance it out with silver and gold on the other. So the Romans made their agreement and they had put the gold and silver to satisfy what they owed. When along came a Gallic chieftain, his name was Brennus, and put his gigantic broadsword on the side of the scales to make the Romans owe even more. And the Romans said, they began protesting and said, hey, we didn't agree to this. We agreed to something else. And Brennus said, vae victis, woe to the conquered, meaning you don't have a say anymore. We already beat you. We get to do whatever we want to do. And that's why from that time onwards, Rome always learned never surrender, no matter what. And this was a lesson that would help them against Carthage. And that's something that every one of us, both in life and whatever happens, you should remember that. Quitters never win and winners never quit. You have to be able to understand that when the going gets hard, the hard get going. Or when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So that's an extremely important lesson, because a lot of people will just quit. And you can't quit, no matter what. You know, the toughest victory is over ourselves, but still, in any other avenue, you have to continue and persevere. With wisdom, of course.
They simply became sailors. They told the story of how they took a Carthaginian ship captive and put it up on the beach and learned how to row it first on dry land. And then went out and finally won a great naval battle over the Carthaginians, and the Carthaginians surrendered, you see, unlike the Romans. And so in 241, the war came to an end, the First Punic War. And the Romans also demonstrated those qualities which, in the eyes of the Carthaginians, made them treacherous. The Romans always believed they were honest. Keeping their word was essential to their quality of piety, their faith with the gods. Carthaginians did not see it that way. Their army had surrendered to the Roman field commander with the terms of a specific indemnity, a specific sum of money, and giving up the island of Sicily. By the time the Romans had finished and the raw Carthaginian army had been disarmed, the Romans added 1,000 talents to that sum. A talent, T-A-L-E-N-T, is enough to pay for a warship. So it was a vast sum of money. They added 1,000 talents to the indemnity and took the island of Sardinia. That is why later on, after the First World War, the Germans would refer to the Treaty of Versailles as a Carthaginian peace imposed upon them by the victorious Allies. Central to this struggle with the Carthaginians the first time was the Carthaginian general Hamilcar. Hamilcar Barker, brave, resourceful, a tactician, a strategic genius, he believed the war could have been won. He was victorious in the field when the Carthaginians surrendered, and he came back to Carthage in 241, embittered. What was Carthage like? This mighty foe of Rome, this home of the family of the Barkas. Carthage began life as a colony. It is located in Tunisia today, right outside the capital city of Tunis. We can visit its ruins there. It began as a colony of the city of Tyre in Phoenicia. The Phoenicians are a bold people in antiquity. Their descendants are the Lebanese today. They were great sailors, great merchants, and Tyre sent out, legend had it, under Queen Dido, a colony. And when Dido arrived, the natives did not want these Phoenicians to settle there, and they refused to give them land until finally they agreed they would give Dido enough land to be that could be surrounded with a hide of a bull. So a very tiny little plot of land. But the clever queen took the hide, cut it up into tiny, tiny strips.
Jimbo Funk.
And carved out a considerable portion of land, and Carthage flourished. It became independent, even as we became independent from Britain. It kept its Phoenician language, a Semitic language related to Hebrew, and Punic is simply a Roman word for Phoenician. It flourished, it sent out colonies of its own, and it would ultimately, by the 3rd century BC, rule over an empire stretching from close to what is Benghazi today in Libya, all the way out to the Pillars of Hercules. Along the coast, the Carthaginians were a commercial people. They had a republican constitution, and in fact, Aristotle admired the Carthaginian constitution for its balance. The people were the ultimate sovereigns, but policy was made by a small senate, largely controlled by the wealthy families. The Carthaginians had an army, but they tended to use mercenary troops. These were officered by Carthaginians, but there was a mercenary army which they tended to employ. Their citizens did not want to serve in the military. So they are very unlike the Romans in that regard, with the citizen militia of Rome. Rome in our year 218 is still very much an agricultural country. Farming is the basis of the economy. Carthage is a commercial republic, and the Carthaginians, as middlemen, carry trade all through the Mediterranean world. The Carthaginians are, like the Romans, a religious people. They are polytheists, like the Romans, believing in many gods. But the supreme god of Carthage is Baal, the Lord. His statues show him fierce-eyed, unlike the goddess Tanit, the mother goddess who frequently sits beside him. And there in Carthage was a great temple to Baal, the supreme god of the Carthaginians. And Roman writers tell us how at supreme moments in Carthaginian history, at times of great crisis, the Carthaginians would take their firstborn son and hurl it into the fires that burned the temple of Baal. Hurl it in alive. Now, for many generations, this was put down just to Roman propaganda. But in fact, archaeologists digging there at Carthage have uncovered the very spot of sacrifice. They have found the calcified bones of these little infants, along with tombstones showing their father handing the child over to the priest, or sometimes himself pitching the child into the flames.
We'll stop right there, but it's a fascinating lecture. This is number two. I think there's 18 total, or 24 total. Each is a half hour long. First one is Romans Publius Cornelius Scipio. Number three is Gaius Flaminius. Four is Quintus Fabius Maximus. Five is Scipio Africanus the Elder. Six is Scipio the Younger. Seven is Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. Eight is Crassus. Nine is Gaius Julius Caesar. 10 is Caesar and Vercingetorix. 11 is Pompey the Great. 12 is Cato the Younger. 13 is Brutus in opposition to Caesar. 14 is Cicero. 15 is Augustus. 16 is Virgil. 17 is Claudius. 18 is Nero. 19 is Trajan. 20 is Hadrian. 21 is Epictetus. 22 is Apuleius. 23 is Plutarch, Suetonius, and Tacitus. And lastly, 24 is Marcus Aurelius, who wrote the famous Meditations. Just a fabulous overview of the Romans. And Famous Greeks is just as good. And the other ones by J. Rufus Fears are, I mean, they're all extremely well presented. It's just, and it's kind of, he's not a Christian per se, but he does, unlike most colleges, which just knock everything that has to do with Christianity, he's actually sympathetic and understanding of it. His famous Romans is the one we're talking about. But yeah, he has quite a few other ones too. He has The History of Freedom, which is a pretty good one. Famous Greeks. Books that have made history, books that can change your life. He's got another course, The World Was Never the Same, Events That Changed History. Life Lessons from the Great Books. Just amazing, amazing man. Okay, so it's top of the hour. Again, this is Speak Free Radio with your host, Ryan Masano, on The Ryan Masano Show. We are on from 3 until 5 Pacific time. That's going to be 6 to 8 Eastern time. And appreciate everybody calling who's listening in. And if you do want to listen in live, you're definitely welcome to hit the triangle and to call in. Okay, it looks like we have Dave with us. We will go to him. And this will be the final hour of our show. Afternoon, Dave. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Ryan, am I coming in loud and clear?
You are.
All right. Technology, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. You never know when this stuff's going to work. That's the problem. Really? I mean, like, I guess that's why people are like, can you hear me okay? You know, it's like, because it's like, you know, you flip a coin. It's on or it's off, right?
Right. Every time I call into a city council meeting, that's how I begin always is, can you hear me?
Yes. And it's right.
Funny to hear the ones that don't like me and they have to like grit their teeth and say, yes, we can. But,
right. Can you hear me? You're like, can you hear me? They're like, yeah,
we can. Yeah. Go ahead. They have to like try to hide that they don't want to hear what you have to say. They can't show that. But,
yeah, right. Exactly.
So, welcome back. I know we had you on last week. We talked a lot about our time spent in the nuclear and Navy. You were on fast attacks. I was on ballistic missile submarines. And I wanted to go over that a little bit more. Also, a few other areas that I wanted to touch on. One was you have your own book publishing company, and I wanted to see if you wanted to go over a few of those books, give a brief overview, if you would, of those, because those are books that cannot be obtained at most libraries and can't easily be obtained on Amazon or schools, or I don't know of a single college in America that has some of the books that are on your website. If you know of one, let me know, but I just don't think they are there.
No, I don't think they're anywhere.
No.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how you don't need to burn books. You could basically limit people's their access to books by just simply leaving them out of the mainstream media in schools. But I guess we'll begin with, again, what we were talking about last week, our time in the Navy.
Yeah.
And I know you were going, telling of your overseas adventures. I don't know if you spoke about your time in boot camp. I'm guessing you went to Florida, Orlando?
No. Actually, when I went in the Navy... When I was in the Navy, what century was that? When I was in the Navy, the boot camps that were around at that time, this was 1980, were, as you said, Orlando, Great Lakes, which was known as, of course, Great Mistakes, and San Diego, California, which was butt up against the Marine Corps recruit training depot, and we heard stories about sailors trying to, you know, get out of boot camp, jumping over the fence and end up in the Marine camp, you know, like, uh-oh, you know, we got another squid. What do you want to do with him? So, yeah, what happened was, because since I was in, well, I got into the nuclear program, and when you did at that time, you could pick whatever boot camp you want. That was one of the perks of being a nuke. You could pick whatever boot camp you wanted to get into or go to. And so I figured, because I had known where I was going to go based on the schedule for nukes, I knew I would be in Great Lakes, Illinois, for A school. And I knew I would be in Orlando for Nuke School, which was there then. And you said you went to a different one, right? Not Orlando, right?
I was Great Lakes. And unlike you, Nuke School, by the time I joined, they had just built a new one over in Charleston.
South Carolina, right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so go ahead. I cut you off. You were about to say something.
Well, so boot camp, I went to Great Lakes, or as you said, Great Mistakes. And I didn't get to choose. I don't know if you said you got to choose boot camp or the A school, but
no, the boot camp. Yeah, that's the only thing we got to choose was the boot camp.
Okay.
And when you were in, was what boot camps were available?
So the only one available was Great Lakes when I joined in 99.
And when did what month did you go in?
February.
Oh,
yes,
boy.
It was freezing cold. For a California boy who had never been up to the snow and never been out of California, five layers wasn't enough. Like a t-shirt, a shirt. a sweater, a jacket, another jacket. None of that was enough.
Did you do a lot of shoveling there?
We did. We did. Yeah, it was just, I'll never forget, just teeth chattering constantly. You'd wake up at god-awful early hours in the morning, and then you'd get out, and you'd be walking down these streets, and you'd hear the, I think they called them ARPOX or APOX, whatever it is, the one that sang out the marching songs. And you'd hear that at like 4 or 5 in the morning when you're hungry and tired. And you hear this one, two, two, two. And you'd hear this because there's like 10 different divisions. Each one has their ARPOX singing it out for the people who are just like, can I go to bed and get some food? But you'd hear this just ringing out in early morning. And it's well, you just cannot forget once you go through that. It's just, and it's incredible. I guess it's a lesson to everybody, or at least it's a lesson to me, is that I was so busy on their regimen. You had no time to get into any trouble whatsoever. You are busy from the time you woke up to the time you went to bed, and you had no solitary time, which I don't agree with that. I think we do need solitary time, but you were just constantly around other people and constantly engaged in stenciling and, all kinds of gas drills that we did. They try to release gas. You probably had the same thing. They released gas. I thought I was dying. My first exposure to tear gas and firefighting. It wasn't dull. For whatever people may say about it, it definitely wasn't dull.
No. But yeah. So you unfortunately had a bad experience in boot camp, and because you only had that one to go to. So since I was going to be in Orlando for Nuke School, which was, you know, about 6 months or more, and since I was going to be in Great Lakes, Illinois for A School, I said, well, I might as well go to San Diego. And I was 19. I'd never been on a plane before. I'd never been really anywhere. You know, I think we had gone to, you know, the furthest south we had gone to from where we lived in New Jersey, which was beautiful when I grew up, was like Washington, D.C. And the farthest north we went was Maine. I think we did go to Canada. My dad had family members there, and some of them are still there. So we went to Canada, which is a weird place. And but I never did anything. You know, we weren't like a family that went on vacation, right? Well, we didn't have the money to do that anyway. But even without the money back then, right, gas was cheap. Everything was cheap enough that a family could get into the station wagon and do a family vacation like that, like in that that movie series with, you know, the Griswolds, right? Chevy Chase. But we never did, unfortunately. So I was like, wow, yeah, I'll go to San Diego. And California was like, you know, just I could only imagine what it was like. Of course, this was 1980, before really cell phones, before our cable had just started. There were, of course, VHS tapes, obviously no internet, you know. So it was much slower time. And so you might have seen, you know, California on the TV or in movies or in magazines, but it wasn't like now. You can, you know, you can get a satellite and zoom in on, you know, somebody's garbage can at their house. And so I got on a plane, which was amazing, and I remember arriving. It was late when I got there. We stopped off in Denver, you know, at the airport for a short layover, and got to California at night, and there were palm trees there. It was amazing. And yes, I went to boot camp there, which was great. It was in at the end of March, and then went to AA school there, and then had a little break after boot camp in August. I left on August 4th of 1980. You know, it was tough leaving. You know, it was a good time. I met good people, and of course the memories were great there. Boot camp in the Navy, as you know, well, I shouldn't say that because I didn't go to boot camp the time you did. Maybe they changed it, but it wasn't like a boot camp in the Army or Marines. It was different. And I was the master at arms in the company. Hmm. And so the master at arms didn't really have to do a lot of the things that, you know, the non-appointed recruits did. So it was I was in like a supervisory position. And they do that based on the test scores, you know, the ASVAB. And so it was a pleasant experience, met some great people, and then went home for a short leave, which was, you know, amazing too, because you're coming off this high of doing something, accomplishing something, and you're like in a whole new world. And then, you know, you're a hero to the family because, wow, you went somewhere, because they have no idea what it's like. They can't just go into boot camp, right, and see what it's like, right? And then went to Great Lakes, Illinois, which is a beautiful state. And by the way, California is absolutely a gorgeous state. You know, as sailors, as young recruits, we didn't have a car. We would take the bus to, like, up to La Jolla. And just magnificent. I don't know what it's like today. Last time I was in California was 2003. But back then it was just a beautiful place. And Illinois was also beautiful. Lots of, you know, foliage, trains, just America. And the drinking age in Illinois, because that's all a Navy guy cares about, the drinking age in Illinois was 21, so we would cross the border to Wisconsin because it was 18. And the town that you would come into, the first town, was Kenosha, Wisconsin. And it had a reputation, as I found out, for like having a bar for every day of the week. And so his Navy guys were like, yeah, let's hit every bar, you know. And I don't think we got past the first one. And that bar, I remember, it had, a draft beer in small little glasses, but they weren't tiny, but they were a decent size. And the cost at that time was a quarter. And you know, you could obviously drink as much as you want. That's why we never left that bar. Kenosha was a great town. It was, you know, Wisconsin, gorgeous state. I had a chance to go up to a town called Toma, which is the monster truck capital of the world. And just, I mean, I've never seen so many stars. So had a short time, but great time in Illinois. And you know, now you think of Illinois and you think of that horrible governor and the horrible policies they have there. But back in the 80s, you know, America was still America. And then from there, I might have gone home again for a short leave, or I might have gone straight to Nuke School in Florida, in Orlando, which is where it was. And I'd never been to Florida before. And that was pretty cool as well. And of course, that was, as you know, it was like school, it was like college, and except for, you know, Navy guys. And we went to this school with the officers because they figured they'd train us all together. I don't know if they did that when you were in there, Ryan.
No, it was in the same building, but there was definitely officers did not train with us in the same classrooms at all.
Word
they used, fraternization,
yes,
which applied to physical relationships, and it also applied to just hanging out. They didn't want us doing anything.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It was a little different, I guess, back then, again, like everything. And so, you know, I guess maybe they did that because on the submarine, or on, I guess, any Navy ship or boat, you would be working directly with the officers, so you were on a more, you know, even basis with them. because you're in close quarters, especially on a submarine. And so, yeah, I went through that. It was very difficult, as I think I mentioned last time I was on your show. And toward the end of it, it was 7 days a week, 15 hours a day. And that was done. I mean, it was, you know, I had never studied that hard before. And, of course, there were people in the class who didn't have to study at all. And they would just come up with the right answers. There was one guy in there, Paul Hoos. And just a great guy. And he would, you know all the answers. And, you know, we'd look at him and growl at him in a joking way. And he'd always smile and just a sweet guy. But, you know, it's great to have a brain that you're able to absorb, you know, that kind of stuff or any kind of stuff and not have to study. I had to study, which, nuclear, well, the coursework we went through. And then, of course, we had to select the facility that we would want to train at. So we got this classroom training, and now the next step would be the hands-on training. And when I was in, what was offered was in Connecticut, Windsor Locks, Connecticut, or near Saratoga Springs, New York State, or Idaho Falls, Idaho. That's where the nuclear prototype training units were. How about when you were in, Ryan? Was it the same?
It was all three branches. After boot camp, you had A school, nuclear NNPTC, and NPTU, the prototype, which was all within a 10-mile radius of each other.
Okay, so repeat those facilities.
First was the Machinist May A School, and that was in Charleston on the exact same grounds where I think the A School was like 3 to 6 months. I can't remember. And then after that was Naval Nuclear Power Training Command, which was the theory behind nuclear power, and that was 6 months, and that was right next door. And then after that was 6 months of prototype, which was, they actually had submarines down in the Charleston Harbor. But it was all within a 10-mile radius, all on the same base. They built everything. They built these nice dorms for us to stay in, and they had basketball courts that they built for us. They had the MWR that you mentioned, but they had like table tennis, air hockey, all this stuff was inside. And so you had plenty of stuff to do to stay out of trouble. Of course, even though the legal age was like 21, and of course, and you would get severe trouble, and they would announce what would happen to guys who got caught. Did not stop. A lot of guys still went, and it was amazing to me. I actually pondered whether I should start, because I never did use alcohol, but it really made me wonder, because like what you said, some guys just picked it up. Like there's guys, they would just go out and get drunk. Gilbert and Puckett, I remember those two of their names. They were hilarious guys, great personalities, and they did very well on tests, and they would get sloshed the night before and then come in and just like do better than everybody else. And I'm like,
right,
man, I'm not trying to live a good life, and I'm sitting here struggling. These guys are like getting tanked, and they're acing everything. This just does not make any sense. But you know, I don't necessarily have events, and I regrets, but I remember too, there, you mentioned the guys that were smart after that in the higher school and at NPTC, the two names that I'll never forget, Matetich and Abear. They were the two that would get like 4.0s on every single test, do very minimal studying, but everybody knew that when the test came, whatever it was, those two were probably going to get the highest scores. I remember, I think I got like a 3.6 on one test. I think I ended up with like a 3.2, something like that.
Right.
I had never touched like wrenches and hammers. That really wasn't my cup of tea. I was much more into like sports and reading and all that stuff, like mechanics and math. I didn't like that stuff, but that's what I ended up in. So yeah, it was it's amazing how after all these years, guys who did well, and I had a group of friends that I hung around with. But yeah, it was pretty amazing experience. Sounds like it was for you as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we didn't have everything, like, you know, right around the corner like you did, which is smart. You know, the Navy did that, but I didn't want to go to Connecticut. I didn't really like Connecticut. You know, I'd been there a few times living in New Jersey. It was relatively close, and I had no desire to go there. It wasn't anything that, you know, I would want to see again. New York State, you know, sounded good. I had been there because not up that far, but, you know, when the bars closed in Jersey at, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock, we would cross the border because we were close to the New York State border because the bars were open later there. So New York was cool. And I didn't really want to go out to Idaho. It just didn't really attract me. And so I picked New York State near Saratoga Springs, a town called Ballston Spa, which New York State is just gorgeous. And that was, you know, Saratoga Springs has the racetrack there and the Saratoga Performing Arts Center. And all these places I went to, I had a great time with my Navy buddies. In California, I remember we saw, when it came out, we went to the movie theater and we saw The Empire Strikes Back, which was amazing because the theater was packed and the only seats that were available were right down at in the first row, all the way like to the left. And you're looking up at this screen, and of course, you know, you had just partied, and you're like, oh, my God. And you hear this spaceship coming out of the, you know, the corner of the screen. It's like, my God, that was just, it was amazing. And, of course, we went to Disneyland in Illinois. We went to a bunch of concerts. We went to an AC/DC, I think it was a Hell's Bells concert. That was great. We saw Molly Hatchet. This is at a different concert in Rockford, Illinois, and a couple other bands, Little Feet. We went to the Black and Blue concert, Black Sabbath and Blue Oyster Cult, and again, America, right? I mean, that's what you did, and it was just fun, and it was safe. You didn't think about any of the bullshit, excuse my French, that you have to think about today. It was just America. Right, it was your country, you know. You were enjoying the land, and in New York State, there wasn't much of that. I did see at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, I saw Santana, so that was cool. I don't remember who opened up for them, but it was great. You know, had a great time in all those locations, and then, you know, you fill out that dream sheet about where do you want to be stationed. And I, for some reason, put down on the dream sheet that I wanted to be on a submarine and stationed out of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, because my fiancé was there. And there was no fiancé, but and I didn't know anybody in Hawaii. I didn't know anything about it, but I got it. So I got that submarine, the USS Skate, and that was, again, you know, as a young kid, you know, 20 something years old, 21, you know, it's just fascinating to, you know, experience these things and to see the world and or the country and then see the world, you know, with the Navy. And it was just a great experience. And unfortunately, nowadays, right, somebody like me and somebody like you and the people that we know and who we know, we probably wouldn't recommend to, you know, a friend or a family member to go into the military right, because of what they've done to it, which is also very sad that they've taken that away. They've taken away a lot from us, right? So the chipping away at the cultural, you know, institutions, the cultural heritage of the country that we had grown up in, that we had known, that generations before us had known, albeit in a different fashion. Of course, the, you know, the original Americans, their experience was, you know, starkly different than ours. However, it was a country that had certain foundations to it. You know, you grew up feeling good about the country. You grew up feeling that the country was something special, that, of course, anyone could be the president if they wanted to. The sky was the limit. And they took that away from us in many ways. Still, you could do whatever you want, but it's a country now that a lot of people are not comfortable in, that, you know, it leaves a bitter taste in your mouth and makes you long for the country, the beautiful country that was there before. And we see who's doing this. And we can identify the perpetrators. And we see them traipsing around with nothing happening to them. Mm-hmm. And we wonder, how could that be? How could these guilty parties, the ones who are letting in illegal aliens and distributing them across the country, or the ones who are allowing Antifa and Black Lives Matter and other terrorist and criminal organizations to burn cities to the ground and nothing happens to them? And we see, you know, the people who went to Charlottesville and held a tiki torch protest, not harming anybody, just holding the torches. And we see prosecutors 6+ years later going after them. One, you know, there was a case that just ended, fortunately, in a mistrial. My friend Jason Kessler, who was the organizer of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, who has a new book out, by the way, on Charlottesville, which you can see at his publishing house, Dissident Press, so it's dissident.press. They're going after these people 6-7 years later for holding a torch. You know, it's like, you know, January 6th, okay, that's recent, but what are you doing? So these people, these prosecutors, the many governments in this country are the enemy of the people, not just the people, but specifically of the white race. And it's so obvious now, and so many people are waking up, that something's going to happen, of course. It's not just going to be like, oh, okay, we know what's happening, and it's going to be a silent, peaceful transition moving from, you know, the Soros-backed prosecutors to an even-handed approach. No, it's not going to be like that. It's not going to be peaceful. It can't be. They've pushed too far. We know who the guilty parties are. You know, a young man from California saw it. And you decided that you know, enough was enough. You decided on your own you were going to get up in front of these governmental bodies, specifically the main one that you frequent, and you were going to give them a piece of your mind peacefully and in an educated way, in a calm way, saying what was on your mind. And we see their reaction to it is violent, and they recoil in horror and when you tell them the truth, like vampires when they're, you know, when you hold a cross up to them or you throw holy water on them. You know, they want to shut you down because you're saying these things. They've arrested you for wanting to talk. I mean, this type of stuff, when I grew up, it would never even exist. There was nothing like that. It was like, you know, you were a citizen. You know, you had a claim in the country. You had your space. There were not like militarized police forces, you know, across the land. There weren't cops just indiscriminately shooting people. And yes, more white American citizens are killed by cops than blacks. That's a fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and if you look at these videos, the whites are generally not resisting. And now it's worse than ever. So they know what they're doing. They took a country. And when I say they, I mean Jews. They took a country that was stable and they completely upended it and they destroyed it. And I've said before, they've brought it to its knees and it's on its knees right now. And it's our responsibility to get it off its knees because no one else is going to do it. We've got to get the country off its knees because it's kneeling now. It was forced down and it's kneeling before the Jewish masters. And it's because most people have no clue who the Jewish masters are, although more are waking up. But I like to compare it to Newton's first law of motion, which says an object at rest remains at rest, and an object in motion remains in motion at constant speed and in a straight line, and that would be America. It was at rest, unless acted upon by an unbalanced force. And that unbalanced force is Jewry, is organized international Jewry. And that's exactly what happened. We could compare America to this first law of motion. When I grew up, America was a very stable country. Yeah, there were racial riots spurred on by the Jews media. Yeah, there were other things. It wasn't perfect, but oh boy, was it unbelievably beautiful compared to what they did to us now. So yes. It's time to lift this country off its knees and look at Ryan, what you do. It's amazing. That's why you're doing the show. You know, you got the attention of a lot of people who were like, wow, listen to this guy. He's telling them like it is. And that's amazing because to do that, it's such a hard thing to do. But we need, you know, like that joke about, you know, Michael Weaver. We need 6 million Ryan Masanos who are going to get, imagine that. I mean, let's say we had not even 6 million. Let's say we had 6 Ryan Masanos. And then we had 60. And how about 600? Then 6,000. At that point, what are they going to do? Arrest the 6,000 Ryan Masanos for exercising their First Amendment rights? So this is what we need. Use Ryan as an example. Get away from that computer screen. It's easy to say, but get away from the computer screen. Go to your city council meeting in a calm fashion like Ryan does. Bring up these points. Let them know what you think. You know, you don't have to scream, you know, you don't have to curse out, you know, anybody. All you have to do is speak your mind. That's what it's there for. And it will have an impact. Like Ryan is just one man, but he's having an impact because he's brave. He's dedicated. He knows exactly what he wants to say, and he's done his homework. So the more people who follow that blueprint, the quicker we're going to get the country up off its knees. And the country is screaming to get up off its knees. And all of us feel that. We all feel uncomfortable with what's happening. And that is because our space has been invaded by these aliens. And these aliens need to know that their time is up.
Right. And I appreciate your kind words. And I was just doing the math. I had actually counted. There's, from what I understand, or close, I'm approximating, but 19,500 American cities. And I did that. I was like, you know, if we had 3 men in each of those cities, so give or take 60,000 men total, which is remotely, it's a fraction of 1% of the American population. 60,003 in each city are getting up at city councils and school boards, which appear to me to be the last open forums open to us at the moment. I don't see how they can stop that, because already if just one man, well, I've seen what I do, I've seen what David Duke has done, what you do, the fierce blowback from the Jewish media, if they have to overreact like that over just a few of us, imagine what 60,000 would do. It would blow the lid clear off the pot. So it's just like it's small strokes fell great oaks. And so people, oftentimes it's overwhelming. You look at this, the daunting media structure, the television's controlled by them, the radio's controlled by them, the newspaper's controlled, social media's controlled, the schools, the unions, the victim groups, the Freemasonic lodges, the criminal gangs, the cartels. So it does seem very daunting, but right makes right. And, you know, by continually, the greatest stone in the world can be worn away by drops of water over time. So, and I don't know if we're, I hope we don't have to do another Reconquista, which Spain had. It took 700 years for them to get rid of the Jews and the Muslims in Spain. So I sure hope that it happens in my lifetime. I'd prefer not to be the first stage of 700 or more years of regaining America. But I mean, clearly, when you look at the facts, the and you mentioned the military and what has happened to it. And, you know, I was just looking at the history of America, and it was like, you know, the founders were very clear. They did not want a standing military because they were afraid of exactly what's happening right now, which our military has been subverted by these Jewish bankers. It seems to me when Wilson, the Jewish bankers took control of the money in 1913, the worst year in American history, as we both know, Federal Reserve and income tax. The following year, they had their pawn. He may have been Jewish. I think he was a Freemason, Gavrilo Princip. Murdered the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Austria, touching off World War I. And of course, you know, this whole, it's always about safety with tyranny. It's always for our safety that we're tyrannized. So it's, oh, we need to be safe. We need to have an army. And it was supposed to be a temporary standing army. Well, how temporary is it? 1913, 14, and what are we, 110 years later, and there's no sign of the end in sight yet. It was supposed to be a temporary income tax and a temporary military, standing military. I've heard nobody announce an end to either one, but I hear constant calls to expand both. So, it's extremely troubling. And for me, as a child, being a oldest of 18, and also reading, I think, you know, the reading Little House on the Prairie, the whole series, just reading of what life was like in early America, like the honest, responsible fathers who had courage, the mothers who were submissive in the home, the children who knew to obey their mother and their father and to honor God and their parents. Where has that gone? We've been so vulgarized by the Jewish parasite. And I'm being careful here because there are many Jews who actually tell the truth. So I'm not including them in this. But if they follow the Talmud, it's a good chance they're involved in this too. I mean, and a lot of Jews, they don't even know. They go to their Talmud or their synagogues, and they have no idea what their rabbi or the Talmud teaches at all. And they, a lot of them don't even know that 70 rabbis or the Kahal rule worldwide Jewry. We don't even know their names. We don't know the names of the bankers who own the Federal Reserve. So there's a lot to unpack. There's a lot to undo. But I think constant exposure, and they say the shortest pencil is better than the longest memory. So that's why your publishing company is so instrumental, is even like I have stuff on the internet and on the radio, but literally the entire internet can be wiped out in 5 minutes, like an EMP attack, and 90% of us would be dead in a year. And virtually vast amounts of information would be gone forever, just like when the library at Alexandria was burned to the ground. So having books in paper form that allow people to be exposed to the truth and enlightening them as to what's really going on is extremely important. The other thing is, too, somehow penetrating your average American's fixation on money, because we're all in such a position that few of us can basically afford to sit down and take a step back and zoom out and not worry about our housing and our food and all that, because, I think it's like 50% of America doesn't have $500 in reserve funds for an emergency. So it's, they've got us in this financial slavery and destitution. And it's very hard when people are in that they're terrorized by that and they're enslaved. It's kind of the same response that you saw what happened to Moses. Moses came to them. He's like, hey, you know, we're going to leave. And they were like, you're going to get us in more trouble. You're getting us more work. Like they made it out like Moses was the problem. And I think that frequently happens to you. I've seen it happen to David Duke. It happens to me. Everyone on our side who tries to blow the whistle, we often run into massive opposition. And to your point earlier about, I think it, you mentioned Newton's first law of thermodynamics. From what I've seen, I heard it. It's like 1% rule the world. That's the Talmudic Jews. 4% are their lackeys. That's basically every famous person, every politician, every celebrity, singer, entertainer, athlete. They're all controlled. A bunch of other agents too. And then 5% are you, me, Zach, David Duke, G, thousands, perhaps millions of us who are frantically trying to spread the truth. And then 90% are asleep. So us 5% are trying to get to that 90%, while the 4% are attacking us and trying to convince the 90% pretty successfully, I might add, that us 5% are a bunch of radical fascists who just want to preserve the white race and or white supremacists. So they make it out that we just love all white people and we just hate all non-white people, which isn't remotely close to the truth. And they've done such a good job at stigmatizing World War II Germany. They throw us into that basket and over half of America's ears are closed to us as soon as they understand that, you don't have a problem with World War II Germany. Oh, you must be an evil Nazi and terrible and attack you. And so, yeah, and I appreciate you going over all of that. Did you kind of catch on to what was going on with Jewry? Did that happen when you were in the Navy, Dave, or did that? No. If you want to go over
how. Yeah, no, happened. I was just a dumb American. For most of my life, I was just a dumb American. And I guess that's one of the downsides to not having to struggle, you know, as much as other folks do, right? I mean, this country was founded on, you know, really risk takers who think about what they did, right? I mean, they came across, you know, oceans and not like luxury, you know, cabins, you know, in transatlantic, you know, cruise ships, liners. They struggled to come here. And they came to a land that, you know, they didn't know and they couldn't check into, you know, the Quality Inn to get a room. Yes. I'd like a room. Yes. I have to, create a country in a little bit. So if you could, any room will do. So these guys had to obviously scratch their existence out of the dirt, literally. And then, of course, as time went on, and things became, you know, more mechanized, right? And, you know, it made it much, much more easy for folks to do the basic things, right? Like they wouldn't have to grow their own crops, or they could actually get around in an automobile or whatever it might be. We became, you know, fat, dumb, and happy. And you know, I was brought up in a time, born in 1960, where, you know, the American dream was, you know, alive and well, and it was just great to be an American. And, you know, it was a time when, you know, you could enjoy the country. As I mentioned before, you didn't have to worry about, some savage, running you over or, you know, killing you, for your car or for your phone or for your sneakers, or for whatever, or because you know, they thought you were somebody who you weren't, and, you know, or because they wanted to kill you because that was what they should do to, you know, get into the gang. You have to prove. So this is what we're dealing with now. We're dealing with something completely out of control. So when I grew up, it was innocent. And, you know, there was no reason to think about, you know, some happy merchant, you know, wringing his hands and, you know, counting his shekels and, you know, putting out poison in the media. They were doing it, of course, but they weren't doing it like they are now. So there was really no motivation. I think it's major occurrences like the broad daylight assassination of President Kennedy, like 9/11, like COVID, like October 7th. It's these major events that cause folks to question things. And so somebody like, and you mentioned before, David Duke, right? David was born 10 years before me. And so in roughly, you know, the mid-60s, David was already questioning the Jews, which is really fantastic if you think about it, because he sensed that something was up. So, you know, I didn't sense anything else because I wasn't thinking about it. I was thinking about girls and drinking and, you know, screwing around, and we didn't have video games back then, really, except for like Asteroids and Miss Pac-Man and a couple other ones. So, I mean, as a teenager, you're just in America, in a calm, stable America, you're not thinking about these things, unless for some reason, you know, you are particularly gifted, or there's a reason for you to think about them. So I, you know, just went through life as just a, you know, a dumb American. And it wasn't until I, you know, had an experience with Wall Street that I began to dig deep into, you know, who's behind the scenes, who's doing this. And that was in the late 1990s when I first started to do it. And that's really what captured my interest. And prior to that, in the late 90s, I was like, let's say 30, 36, 37, 38, right? So I had read my first book like 10, 15 years earlier. I didn't read. I didn't do anything. I was a waste, you know? I was like a teenage wasteland, right? I mean, that's just, you know, the way a lot of kids were. And probably one of the reasons I went into the Navy, I wanted some structure. I wanted to get out of the house and do something, right? It was time to do something. So no, Jews were the last thing on my mind. The evidence then led to the Jews. And then, of course, when it does lead to the Jews, then, you know, you have nowhere else to go. I mean, there's that's why, right. scores and scores of folks are waking up every day, literally. And, you know, it's the Jews, stupid, right? I mean, like they say, every single time. And I got to the point where I realized that, you know, every time, no matter where I went, you know, there was a Jew behind the door. You know, when you're talking about, you know, studying, things that happen in the world that, you know, are not good for people. But now, like I said, this was back then, right? Back in the 90s and the noughties, you know, this was so new. Even though Duke was talking about it, it was just a fringe of folks who were smart enough, and I wasn't smart enough, who were smart enough to understand who the true culprits were and still are. So I caught up, you caught up, all these other folks caught up to Duke and the other people. You know, and there's other great people like Duke who did, you know, were able to sniff them out, right? Or to use the analogy of the eyeglasses, right? That movie, They Live. They could see them. We couldn't see them. It wasn't something that we had any reason to see them, but they saw them. And of course, they were treated by the Jews media like lunatics, like Nazi lunatics. But at least they interviewed them in those days, right? They were on talk shows. They were on regular shows. They were given airtime for their views. Now they just say, forget it. You know, you're quarantined, you're censored, you're banned. Your views are not getting out there. Now you're a denier. If you don't believe in their Holocaust, you're a denier, and they don't give you any airtime. If you don't believe in their climate narrative, you're a denier. If you don't believe in their vaccine narrative, you're a denier. So we've reached a point in this country where obviously the lines are drawn. We know what side we're on. We're on the denier side, and we're happy to be on that denier side. So we need to just gain the power via our own media, which we are, to counter their poison. And that's something that I realized too late. You know, doing this for a quarter century, I wish I would have understood that the media is the biggest problem that we face.
It is.
Yes.
It is.
But I didn't. I wasn't smart enough.
Yeah, I've got to the point to where now when I go to Sacramento, I try to, because two of the guys that go with me, actually, there's four. It's amazing because we're calling out the Jewish problem. And of us five who go up there, three are black, two of us are white. And I've told a lot of them, try to stay away from personal attacks because these people are not our enemies. Some of them are corrupt, like Mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg, he might be corrupt. Kaplan, she grew up in a synagogue. She's just, I mean, if you and I grew up in a synagogue, we'd probably be singing the same tune she is. But the others are just, they're just ignorant. And so I told them, like, don't aggressively go after them. What we have to do is go after the media. Like I've told them, like in every single time we get up there and talk, we are the media. Like, we are better media for California and America than any television station, any radio show, in any newspaper. Yes, I know Fox is paid billions, CNN is paid billions. We're worth billions. We tell the truth. Those people lie for billions. We tell the truth for, and we can't even find two nickels to rub together. So this is why so few people are encouraged to come into our movement, because it's basically a life of hardship. And I mean, you could work hard and make a job, but even your regular job is under threat, because these people they're not content that you don't have the billions they have, that you don't have the money tree, you're not able to print out trillions. No, they're not content with that. They want to take away the little you do have. They want to target you for that as well. But I was trying to let them know, like, as much as possible, like the Sacramento Bee, they overreached this whole when I got arrested. Basically, it's kind of like in warfare. If you could, I do it all the time. Whenever I play these strategy games, you'll send a scout ahead, and there's a big army over there. So you send your scout to go like charge them, go right in close to them, and then retreat and have them run after you, and then lead them right into your big army. Well, that's what they just did, because now when it's called strategic retreat in history's best generals, Caesar, Alexander, they were masters at it. They would make you think they were running away. So then you would take all your troops and be like, oh, they're running away. Let's catch them. And you would go helter skelter, boom, right into a trap, and you are not getting out of it. The jaws closed, and that was it. And so right now the media is overreached. And this is why us getting up and speaking is so instrumental, because by doing so, you're basically, it's a Mike Tyson. You're hitting them in the mouth. They don't know how to respond. And of course, they're thugs. Their leaders are thugs, at least. So what do they try to do? They've had Antifa come. The Sacramento Bee is now on record as saying that I got arrested. They didn't say who accused me. They didn't say what the charges were. They didn't announce that it was overturned. So now they're going to have to explain that, and they're not going to be able to. So they're caught. They've got a lawsuit head their way. They've got to answer for this. And just exposing these liars in the media to where we've somehow got to detach the average American's mind from Jew vision, Hollyweird, radio, social media. Like, we have to get to the point to where everyone, it is a, we got to name and shame. You should be ashamed for being on Twitter, ashamed for being on Facebook, be watching television still. I mean, how do you not know? You know, I guess, I mean, we were all ignorant at one point. I used to watch sports ball on the Jew vision as well. But at some point we have to like wake up and say, yes, this was me, but I'm going to move past this. And I think you know, about 2 to 15%. Once we got 2 to 15% of Americans on board with what you and I are talking about, Dave, I think at that point you have a juggernaut and there's no stopping it. The problem I have right now, I don't think that we lack the power to actually do it. The thing is, after we take control of the media and all that, I think we have to do what Germany did, which to my mind is the greatest economic miracle in recorded human history, to replace the money. It's the money and information that are their twin vampire weapons. And if we do like overthrow everything they have, they go running away and we don't get control of money, we're in trouble. And even if they go running away, we take control of money and information, they could still do to us what they did to Germany. The Germans kicked them out. And what happened? They just got all the other nations of this world against Germany. And then that's a distinct threat to us as well, because if they go running away, they'll go running to the China, Russia that they control, England, France, Africa. It's the technologically advanced countries we need to be concerned about. And then, of course, we have to be concerned. Israel is has a Samson option. They've got nuclear weapons. And if we think that they're afraid to use them, I think we're mistaken. So,
I think
anyways,
you're right.
We are almost at the end. We got about 3 minutes left. Thank you very much for coming on again, Dave. Look forward to working with you. This radio station has performed phenomenally. Recommend all Americans who are tuning in to share this. If your friends are not listening to this and they're listening to the whatever's on their dial, your friends are deceived and deluded. So do you have any closing remarks for everyone?
Yeah, it's just great to be here, Ryan. Thank you for inviting me on. I always have a great time shooting the breeze with you. And I know Hoax Busters is coming up next, and I do a show now on Tuesdays between Eastern Time, 1 to 3, and I'm going to have as a guest, I think, this Tuesday, Will Williams, the head of the National Alliance. So check that out if you can. Thanks, Troy.
Will do. Hey, thank you very much again. Really appreciate your time, Dave. And
thank you for listening
great weekend
to The Ryan Masano Show. Tune in every Saturday and Sunday nights on SpeakFreeRadio.com for more of Ryan's takes on the eternal truths, traditional values, and divine insights. Remember, truth is hate for those who hate the truth. And Ryan and Speak Free Radio champion the truth. See you next time.